Now today we're into the second sermon in a series of sermons where we're looking at the stories that Jesus told. Last week we started with the prodigal son, and today we're talking about the parable of the wineskins. But when I started looking at this, the wineskins parable, it made me think of an instant in my life that I had to take a step back and really consider what I was doing. I use my computer every day. I'm sure you do the same thing. Actually, our phones really aren't phones. They're computers with a phone app, when you think about it. I mean, these things are so powerful, what we have in that little block, right? But for me, getting my first real computer back in the 1990s, I know, kids, some of you are thinking, wow, the horses and buggies and stuff. No, we were driving cars then, too. But we got our computers, and something came out that just changed my world, and that was Office 95. Microsoft Office 95 was a little office suite of three programs. Remember this? I think it was Word, Excel, and what was the third one? Access. It was those three. All right. Then the ground shook in 1997 when Microsoft Office 97 came out because it had Outlook. All right. And Outlook changed my life because with Outlook, you had an email capability to email, manage your contacts, and your calendar all in one thing. Okay. We were using things called Palm Pilots and stuff. You remember those? But this came out, Office 97, the Microsoft Office suite, was incredible. Kevin, can you put up the first? There you go. You remember what this looked like? Now, mine looked a little different than this. Down the left-hand side, you see those icons are really small, inbox, send. Mine were really big, like postage stamps, all right? And down the left-hand side, I mean, this changed my life. I would hit one of those, and it was like gears were turning, and that email was gone. And you remember when you would attach, well, some of you remember, you would attach a document. You know what I'm talking about. That little paper clip would come up in the lower head corner. You remember? With the little smiley face document, and he'd go, that's how I knew my document went. All right? This changed my life. Everything, the way I organized my communication, everything was just, it was wonderful. And then something horrific happened. I opened up my Outlook one day, and it looked like this. And I was ticked off. I was very, very angry. Who took my program that I was using it, and my nice big icons, and my little guy with the paperclip was gone, and my life was over. I mean, I was really good. I had my heels firmly planted. I was writing Bill Gates a letter, and I was telling him he lost a customer. Now, I know that would have shaken his world, right? you know, this you can't change somebody's life like that, all right? But I had to send an email. So I fumbled my way through it, grumbling the whole way. I sent an email, all right? And the next day, I had to send a couple more emails, so I sent a couple more emails, and I was really, you know, all these icons are so small, and there's stuff all over the place, and that toolbar, who would ever make a toolbar like that? But after about a month, I was like, you know, this isn't so bad. You know, I don't, the smaller icons allow me to put more on one screen. I don't need all that big, you know, and the little guy with the paperclip, our relationship was over, you know. And I was like, you know, this isn't so bad. I got used to the new colors, and I started to organize my life in a whole new way. And these programs were integrated, and they were working back and forth. I became more productive, which is what they wanted. They want us to become more productive and do these things. And so today I stand here and tell you, as I have changed my life and adapted, the new version of Outlook is probably the best idea Bill Gates ever had. I got used to it. But I struggled with the change. Something changed and I didn't like it. Something was different and I didn't like it. And that's our human nature. So as I read to you today, the story that Jesus said, the parable of the wineskins, if Jesus told the story today, it would be the parable of Microsoft Office Suite 2010. Because he's using a story that people around him would know. That's what we understand. That's what we know. Hey, I want to remind you, there's a set of sermon notes in your bulletin. If you want to follow along in there and make any notes as you go along, that's there for you. If God speaks to you, and I always pray that God speaks to us in a certain way, and you want to write that down, I encourage you to do that. If I don't write it down, I don't remember it. I want you to do the same thing. So here's the thing. The truth is we all struggle with change. We all struggle with those things in our life that change. And that's really the only constant, right? The only constant in life is things are going to change, and we can't do anything about it. We like things to stay the same. We want things to stay the same. you know something? And I used to think that I like change. You know this about me. Ever since I got here 4 years ago, I've been here 4 years, you know. I've been preaching change, talking about change. I told you as a church, look, church, you got to be willing to change. You got to embrace change. You got to do this or the church will die. The world's going to change. We can't control that. We can control what we do, and we have to embrace that change and move forward. And if we don't go along with it, well, you know, we're going to die. So I embrace change. I love change. I absolutely love change. Then I realized when I experienced some other people making some changes, started thinking to myself, we never did it that way before. You know, I reacted a little bit, and that disturbed me. Some people wanted to do ministry a little bit different, in different ways, and I started saying to myself, well, it's working now. Why do we want to monkey with this? Just leave it alone and make it happen. And that's when I had the true realization. I do love change. I love change. I embrace change, as long as I'm the one initiating the change. Okay? It's who we are. It's human nature. And we look at that and we say, wow. I know the older I get, the less I like change. The older I get, the more I want things to stay the same. So I have to work at this. And my guess is today, as we look at this together, a lot of people here feel the same way that I do. It's difficult. It's difficult to embrace change. And when we look at these, we really want to know, as we look at these parables and we go through this sermon series, we want to know, what was Jesus trying to tell the people of his day, and what is he trying to tell us today in this parable of the wineskins? Okay, what does it mean for us? And to get to that, remember what we talked about last week. The first thing we have to do when we start looking at a parable is we have to back up, and we have to go to what Jesus was doing prior to that, and we have to discover context. We have to put his statement into the context of where he was in order to understand, number one, what the message was that he was trying to get through to the people that day, in order for us to somehow digest it and find the message for us today. And we remember what a parable is, right? Jesus would take some theological idea, some complex spiritual theory, and what he would do is he would take something very simple and he would throw it down alongside it. And then he would say, this is like this. And the people always didn't get the spirituality. They wouldn't always get it, but they had something to compare it to. And he always gave them something that would be, without question, something that they understood. And they understood old wineskins. So we might need to understand old wineskins to really determine what Jesus was saying. So we need to go back and we need to look at that context that he was talking about. And in order to do this, we have to jump the whole way back to the fourth chapter of Luke, verse 16. And we have this incredible story here where Jesus is in his hometown of Nazareth in the synagogue giving his very first sermon. Now, I remember my very first sermon. More than anything, I wanted the people in the church, and it was here in this church, you know, I wanted the people in the church way back in the last century. I wanted you to like it. I wanted to walk out into that lobby, and I wanted people to say, good job, Tom, pat me on the back, say, you did a good job. You know what? I'm sure Jesus is in the same place. So Jesus comes to his hometown of Nazareth in his synagogue, and he gives his very first sermon. And what did they do after his very first sermon? They march him out to a cliff and try and throw him off. I don't think it was the home run he was shooting for. Okay? Jesus, in that sermon, gave them the idea that the scriptures weren't just for them. The scriptures were also for the Gentiles. And that disturbed them. That was change. And they did not like that. And they wanted Jesus out of the picture as soon as possible. It did not go so well. So then we go a little bit later in Luke chapter 4, and what do we find Jesus doing? Healing on the Sabbath. Jesus, you don't heal on the Sabbath. That upsets people. That's something that you shouldn't do. Then in Luke 5, beginning of the ministry, right, he gets right into calling his disciples. Now, what does a good rabbi do in those days? If you're going to call a disciple, you get on to the local seminary. You're sure to get a guy who can read, write, and who have a little idea about theology. The rabbi takes it the rest of the way from there. What does Jesus do? He goes down to the dock and looks for some sailors. You know what those sailors are like. He brings a couple of fishermen back, and he says, come and follow me, and I'll make you fishers of men. And they look at that, and they say, who are these guys? And it goes on. He's calling his disciples, and then we get up to verse 12 in Luke chapter 5. In verse 12, we find the story about how Jesus comes across a man who has leprosy. And we all know about lepers back then. The law said that as lepers move about, they're out to let everybody know, unclean, unclean. That way, everybody could stay away from him. They could keep a distance, because what they thought was, if you come in contact with a leper, you could get sick or you could make somebody else sick. So the leper comes to Jesus and he says, Jesus, can you heal me? And Jesus reaches out his hand and he touches him. Jesus, you don't do that. Forget the fact that the leprosy disappeared and he was healed. They never saw the healing. They saw the fact that he was doing something new. There was a new form of religious practice. He touched a leper. Jesus was doing something new. Up in verse 17, we find Jesus. Okay, we're almost one chapter into his ministry. And here he runs into some serious problems with the Pharisees. It took one whole chapter of his ministry. And he runs into the Pharisees were the preachers of the day. And it tells a time when Jesus was preaching and the Pharisees were listening, and these friends bring this paralyzed man into Jesus and they say, Jesus, can you heal our friend? And Jesus looks down and before he says, you're healed, get up and take your mat, before he says anything else, he says, son, your sins are forgiven. And the Pharisees step back and they say, who dare to forgive sins but God himself? And they say, this man is a blasphemer. And then he says those words, get up, take your mat, and walk. You're forgiven. But he was doing something new. It was a change. It was something that they'd never seen before. And from that time on, it would be Jesus against the Pharisees. And it's not long until we get down to verse 27, and Jesus leaves that place, and he goes out from that place, and he comes across a notorious sinner. This guy did it all wrong. Everybody knew how bad this guy. They knew him as Levi or Matthew. And Jesus goes up to him and he says, hey, you know something? You could be one of my disciples. Come and follow me. I'm going to teach you to fish, but you're going to fish for people. And so what is Matthew's response? Matthew responds like a lot of us would. We're going to throw a party. We're going to celebrate. So Matthew invites all his friends. And who does Matthew hang out with? He hangs out with all the sinners and the other tax collectors and the prostitutes. And they all come together and they have this celebration dinner. And Jesus is there. And the Pharisees say, look at him. He even eats with sinners. Now remember what Pharisee means. Pharisee means to be separate from. Their idea of piety and righteousness was to dissociate from those who sin. Keep your distance. And here Jesus is at the same table as they are. And then we come to verse 33, which falls right before our scripture for today. And the Pharisees come to Jesus and they say, Jesus, why don't you fast? And why aren't you teaching your disciples to fast? Now, the Pharisees fasted twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays. That's what they did. Scriptures instruct us to fast once a year. But the Pharisees knew God would really be happy with them. The mega piety, the mondo righteousness comes the more you fast. So twice a week they did it. And they wanted to know, Jesus, why don't you do that? And why don't you instruct your disciples to do that? Again, Jesus was doing something new. They knew he wasn't the spiritual person that others thought he might be. Jesus was breaking all the rules, and he was teaching ways about God that made other people uncomfortable. And it wasn't going very well. They were anxious. They were unsettled. They were disturbed by all of these things. And the truth is, people like it better the old way. People don't like change. That's the context. That's the backdrop of the parable of the wineskins. This is what's happening up to this point. And Jesus looks at these people and he knows. He knows their lens. They're looking at the lens of God through everything that they know. And everything that he's doing does not fit into that lens. It does not harmonize. And those folks like it better the old way. Let's hear it again. No one puts new wine into old wineskins, otherwise the new wine will burst. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. And no one, after drinking the new wine, wants the new wine, they say the old is good. And that's puzzling for us. When we hear these parables, that's confusing for us. And it's confusing for us because none of us grow grapes in our backyard. Everybody who heard this grew grapes in their backyard. None of us make wine. Well, some of you might be making wine, and that's okay. Nothing against that. But in those days, everybody made wine. Now, this fall, in the middle of October, you're going to see that little thing on your calendar. If any of you have those calendars that call out the Jewish holiday, Sukkot, somewhere around April 15th. It's always in the middle of October. Sukkot is the celebration, the Feast of the Booths. And it's a celebration of when Israel came out of Egypt. It's a remembrance of all that time they spent in the wilderness that they lived in tents. So if you have the wonderful occasion to go this fall to a friend's synagogue, you're going to see little tents and booths set up in the narthex or the lobby. That's part of the celebration, remembering what was happening. This concurred with the harvest time. At the very same time they're setting up their booths, they're bringing in all those grapes from the field and all that other fruit. And they're preparing as a community to make wine. Each of them didn't have a wine press. They had a community wine press. Bring up that first diagram, Kevin, of the wine press. This is a diagram of what it would have looked like in the old days. The whole community comes and they throw their wine press onto the treading floor. And everybody would be in there stomping on those grapes. I'm sure they washed their feet and did all that good stuff first. But kids, old people, everybody could get in there and stomp those grapes. It's a huge area. And then there was a little doorway, a little gate that would have some thorns and things put in there to catch the grapes and stuff to keep them from going out. And just the juice would go down that little trough and it would go into what they call the vat. Okay? Then they would take and cover that vat for a week. And what's happening during this week is there's natural yeast that occurs on the grape. And some of that goes with the juice down into that vat. And what happens is it starts to ferment. It gives off two things. And we know what that is. One's alcohol. And the other one is CO2, carbon dioxide. And they would leave it sit in there for a week. And then what the whole community would do 1 week later is they'd come with their wineskins. And they would all receive their wine. It would be poured into the wineskins. And then they would seal that wineskin. And they would take it back to their domicile, their tent, wherever they lived. And they would hang it up for 1 year. Okay? And during that year, that new wine would continue to ferment in that wineskin. And it would continue to give off alcohol and carbon dioxide. And what would happen to this wineskin is it would blow up like a balloon. It would start to stretch. But they wouldn't touch it. They would leave it in there. Go to the next picture, Kevin. It's a wine. This is something we're going to see when we go to Israel. This is near the Garden Tomb. This is an ancient wine press that's in there for everybody to see. You can see there's plenty of room there to stomp those grapes. And it would go down into that vat, and they would cover it up. And they would come back and put it in these wineskins. Well, and we ask ourselves, this is all about wineskin. What's a wineskin? Go to the next picture, Kevin. This is a wineskin. Now, this is a Bedouin man. This is a modern picture. He's using this wineskin to actually churn. So he's got it set up on a tripod there. He probably has cream or some dairy product in there. He's either making cheese or butter or something. And he just shakes it back and forth. It's continually moving. But that's the same thing that they would put the wine in. They take the wineskin, which is a goat skin. They clean the goat. They skin the goat and keep it as whole as possible. And then they would take each leg. And they would seal those legs with some twine, and then they'd put a strap between the front and the back legs. It's like a big purse so they could carry it. Where the neck was, that was where they would fill it and where they would pour the wine back out. Okay? So these wineskins were big. Now today we see bodas. We see those little wineskins. If you look at that very closely, it looks like the rear leg of a goat. It's because that's what they would have used. They would have used the rear leg of a goat and they would have sewed it up, and then they could carry small quantities. But this is what the wine fermented in. And you can see how that wineskin is bloated up. That whatever's in there is giving us gas. They would let that sit for a whole year, and then at the end of the year, they would take it out. And what would they have left? An old wineskin. And what happened to that old wineskin is over that year, it was stretched to capacity. It was stretched as far as it could go. And the alcohol had tempered that leather, and it has gotten, it's almost to the point of being brittle now. So people say, with resources being short, what do we do with this old wineskin? If someone said, put new wine back into it, they would have all laughed. that's a stupid thing. You can never do that. You can never put new wine in old wineskins. Because as soon as you put it in there and you put it and you hang it up and it starts to give off the alcohol and the CO2, it starts to expand, there's no place left to expand. It's just going to pop. And all your good new wine is going to go right on the ground. This is the metaphor. This is the analogy that Jesus is using with them to help them understand what's going on. And they knew that immediately. They knew that immediately when he told that story. This is like this in answering to how the Pharisees were treating him. Old wineskins, new wine, it doesn't work. The question is, what does that mean for us today? What did it mean for them back then? How does it shape who we are and how we live? Well, here's what I think Jesus meant for the people back then. I think he looked at those Pharisees and he saw that they were questioning everything that he was doing. He saw the Pharisees and they were following around, and they cannot fathom that he has the gall to eat at a table with sinners. They can't fathom that he has the understanding and the power to forgive sins. They can't believe that he can look at spirituality and practice it in a new way. And what Jesus is telling them is, there's a whole lot of old wineskins around here. And it's not good. Our forms of religion, our theology, the way we practice it, they all might be stuck in the past. And Jesus says, you've got to be pliable. Because when God works, it might not be the way you think he's going to work. So you've got to be able to expand. And you've got to be able to move. And you've got to be tempered a little bit by it. Because things are changing. Allow God to do something new. Hey, that's what we heard in Isaiah 43 this morning, right? Can't you see it? God says, I'm doing a new thing. All through the Old Testament, that's the message. God's saying, I'm doing something new. And that's what Jesus said. He says it right here. He says, who, when drinking new wine, does not say, I prefer the old. We all want the old. We all want that. So Jesus is saying, in order to be able to deal with the gospel that I'm offering you, in order to be able to accept this, these interpretations, you need to be a pliable wineskin. Let your mind, your heart, your whole community be flexible. And here's the truth of it. This is the sad truth. The wineskin that Judaism offered could not hold the new wine that Jesus was giving them. The old wineskin of Judaism could never accept it, because 3 years later, they hang him on a tree. And it's his blood that's poured out. This is serious business. He shook the place up. All right, and it was how he was teaching. They called him a heretic, a blasphemer, demon-possessed. And we have to remember that during the time Luke is writing this, it's 30 or 40 years after Jesus' death. So we're up for 60 or 70 AD. What's happening at 60 or 70 AD as the people are reading this? All the Christians are being expelled from the synagogue. All right, now, through most of history, it's the Christians who are torturing the Jews, who are against the Jews. But at this point, 60, 70 AD, the Jews are saying, what you're teaching is not what we're teaching, and they kicked them out of the synagogue. So all these people who are now Christians who grew up in that place have been kicked out. They knew what old wineskins were. They could understand this. All right? And it's one of the things that happens. How can we apply this text to ourselves today? You know, one of the things that we get used to is we get accustomed to stuff around here. We get accustomed to the songs that we're singing. We get accustomed to our worship time. We get accustomed to how a sermon's delivered. We get accustomed to the words that are said, how we take communion. We get accustomed to how the church looks out front, how it looks inside. And we don't like it when that stuff gets changed. That rocks our world. And certain things can happen, and we'll say, that's horrific. How can they change that? The way people dress, the way things happen. And this might surprise you. I don't want you to be shocked here. But I know you like to sit in the same seats every week. The secret's out, okay? See, I'll tell you what, at my last church, I was up preaching one day, and I didn't see what was happening on, but a lady came in. Came right up here about where Reuben is. And there are two visitors sitting in her seat. And she looked down at them. She said, can't you count? 1, 2, 3, 4. This is where I sit. They didn't move. She sat somewhere else. I found out that week, people were horrified because they witnessed it. They came to me and said, Tom, we can't keep this to ourselves. I have to tell you what happened. And they told me. So what did I preach on the next week? Old wineskins. And in the middle of the sermon, you know what I did? I said, so here's what we're going to do. We're all going to get up. And I made them cross the aisle and all sit in new seats. After the service, they took me out looking for a cliff. It's who we are. It's our nature. But Jesus says, go against that nature. Go against that. Be something different. Be pliable. You know, and here's the thing. Do you think everything that we do now and 20 years from now is going to speak gospel to our children? These kids that are here that we're ministering to, that we're saying, this is the future of our church. Look, folks, here's what's happened in the last 60 years. When the culture changed, the church did not change to meet that culture. And we've lost a whole generation. They're not in church anymore. It's the graying of the church. And if we don't change now, if we don't accept this, what happens is 20, 25 years from now, there's a whole bunch of you whom I love very, very much. You won't be here anymore. And there's a whole bunch of you that are down here that are young. You're not going to be here anymore either. And it's going to be a bunch of people my age. They're going to be gray hair, and we're going to be sitting here singing the same old songs, doing the same old thing at the same old worship time. And we're going to be alone. And the church will die. That's what Jesus is asking us. Be open to this. Do you know that only 4% of Christianity resides in the United States? 4%. 96% of the Christians aren't even American. And we think we're hot stuff. Folks, this is serious business. And you know something? When I got here, very early, probably within my first 3 or 4 months, one of the young new people came up and said to me, he said, Pastor Tom, can I take my coffee in the sanctuary? And I started to go, I held myself back. Because I grew up, you never took food or drink into the sanctuary. Absolutely no way. I said, you know what, you go ahead. You go right ahead. Somebody saw me do that. And you came and talked to me afterwards. You came and told me that that was irreverent and we can't let that happen. I got very angry. I got extremely angry. And I said the irreverence is when we turn somebody away at our door because they want a warm beverage while they worship. And then I told them the story about our Moravian friends. Our Moravian friends, if you don't accept their warm beverage and their ginger snap, they're put off. They stop worship in the middle, and a little clinky cart, just like you're on the airline, comes along and gives you your cup of hot cider and your ginger snap. And you have a little conversation with the person next to you, and then the clinky cart comes back, and you put it back on, and you continue in worship. Or I think about our friends in Judaism, right? What is the highest form of worship in Judaism? What is the highest holiday? Passover. Do you worship the Passover? No, you eat the Passover. And then I begin to wonder, who's more biblical? Maybe it's not us. Maybe we need to think about these things. You see how it works? That's kind of unsettling, isn't it? That's unsettling. But we have to think about this. So what if our leadership comes in here and says, you know, our leadership comes in and they say, for the sake of reaching this new generation, we need to change our worship times. We need to worship at 9:30 and 11 because that's what's going to reach most of the people. My question is, how many of you are going to write me a letter? And you're going to say, Pastor Tom, not my cup of tea. I'm going to have to find a new church. How many of you are going to write me a letter and say, you know, Pastor Tom, it's not what I want, but if it reaches new people, I'm on. We're in this together. How pliable are your wineskins? What is a major thing? What's an essential thing and what's a minor thing? We need to think about this. You know, God gave us all these things. We look at this and it's much broader than the songs that we sing in our worship. Okay, some of you are looking at me right now saying, what's he saying? Is he changing something? I'm not changing anything. I'm not talking about it. I'm saying we need to be open to these things. Because for too long, we've taken the forms of religion, and we've taken scripture, and we've locked God up, and we said, this is it. And every time that happens, we lose space, we lose time, we lose a generation. Go back to the 16th and 17th century. Galileo comes walking in and says, hey, I figured something out. The sun doesn't revolve around the earth. The earth revolves around the sun. What'd they do? Heretic, put him in chains. Recant, and we'll let you out. He recants. He's got his fingers crossed, you know, and then he says, well, the earth still revolves around the sun. You know, 100 years later, what happens? The church says, well, maybe our ancestors didn't quite know science the way we know it today. Yeah, the earth revolves around the sun, but it's still the center of God's universe. All right? I don't care. Slavery, women in ministry, food, pick your topic. We've had to become pliable to get through these things, and we're still in that place. We still got to be able to do that. We've got to have these new wineskins in order to understand what God's trying to do with us in the scriptures and in other places. You can apply it to anything. Now, last week, I need to finish with this. Last week, we worked our way through the prodigal of the lost son, the parable of the lost son, the prodigal son. Prodigal means to waste lavishly, okay? And remember, in that, we have the lost son, the prodigal son. He's the one that demands his inheritance, heads off to a distant country, and squanders all of it, all right? The Father, who represents God, and by the way, we're the lost son. Most of us are willing to admit we've screwed up. We've messed up in a big way. All right? The Father is meant to be God, God who stands at the edge of the field and watches and waits for that lost son to come back, right? When he sees him, he runs to him. Before the son can even apologize, he says, I love you, you're back. Let's throw a party. Let's do it all, right? So that's God and the sinner. But what we didn't talk about was that older son. The older son represents those people who have been in the church for a long time. They do all the right things. They come in on Sunday morning and they fast and they do it all just right, and their pious, righteous lives are right there for everybody to see. And you remember what happens to the older son? Do you remember the story? He comes back in from the fields, and he's like, that sounds like a party. What's going on? So he goes over to one of his servants, and he says, hey, what's going on? What's the celebration all about? And he says, haven't you heard? Oh, my gosh, your younger brother has come back, and your father's throwing him a party. And that older son gets very, very angry. He's livid, and he won't go into the party. And eventually the father's like, where's my other son? And he comes out of the party, and he comes over to him, and Jesus tells us, I love what we expect it to be, what the heck is wrong with you? I smite you, or something. You know, it's none of that. Jesus tells us that he comes over to him, and he pleads with him. He says, please come into the party. Please come to the party. Come celebrate with us. And that older brother's like, absolutely no way. Do you know what that kid did? That kid took all of his inheritance. He went over there. He spent it all on prostitutes and riotous living. And now he comes back, and you're giving him a party. You never gave me a party. And the dad says, please. Your younger brother was once dead. Now he's alive again. Join the celebration. That's where the story ends. That's where we get to make the decision. Are we going to be like the younger brother? Or are we going to be like the older brother? And here's what it comes down to, folks. When it comes down to issues of fairness and justice, or love and mercy, whenever those two things come together, God chooses love and mercy every time. Every time. And we need to be very, very happy about that, because if that wasn't the case, then there's not a one of us that would be here today. And for that, we need to be very, very thankful. So what's our job in all this? What do we do? You know, we need to be the ones who are welcoming those who are returning to God. We need to be those who take those teachings that Jesus gives us and turn it into love and mercy in our own lives. And when we're unsettled by some new form or some new practice or some new theology, we need to step back and look through the new lens of Jesus and find out exactly where we are. So we got to ask these three questions. Number one, today for us, who are the Pharisees? Who are trying to separate people? Who are the ones that are keeping those who are out, and those who are in? Who are the Pharisees today? The second part of the question is, who are the sinners and tax collectors in our lives? Who are the ones that Jesus is begging us to bring into the fold that is the church? Who are those people that they make us feel a little uncomfortable when we're around them? And the final question is, how pliable are your wineskins? How open are you to the new practices that God has for us in the future? And here's my hope and my prayer. It's that the Wayne Church family will always be those pliable hearts and minds in a community where everyone is welcome to come and play a part in the role of God's kingdom as we see it. For that, we need to be thankful. Let's pray.